It's 6 after 10. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network. According to author Eric Weiner, we're being robbed. But before you start thinking about someone in a mask holding a gun, think again. In this case, the thieves are wealthy countries and investors who are robbing U.S. markets. He makes his case in a new book titled The Shadow Market, How a Group of Wealthy Nations and Powerful Investors Secretly Dominate the World. Eric Weiner joins me by phone this morning to talk about his book and answer your questions on this topic. Eric Weiner, good morning and welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me, John.
First of all, what do you mean by the term shadow market?
Well, it's sort of a misnomer in that it's not a market in the way that we consider markets typically, which doesn't have an address. It's not like there's no Wall Street or New York Stock Exchange. There's no physical plant. There's no index to track or anything like that. Basically, what it is something that's existed throughout the history of of finance, which is the mechanism for liquidity, the mechanism for getting people money, and getting countries money, and getting businesses money. And for the longest time, since the United States became the dominant economy in the world, we controlled the mechanisms of this shadow market, whether it was through our own government aid or through institutions that we ostensibly controlled, like the IMF and whatever else, the World Bank. And we, by doing that, provided money throughout the world to various different economies by buying up things and by moving money around. And this conferred on us a tremendous amount of power, and it enabled the United States to go to places and do things that it normally wouldn't be able to do because we were the leading economy on Earth. And particularly after the Soviet Union fell, the wall came down, we were left as the sole superpower, and the world had to come to our door. Over the last decade, really, this has started to shift as our budget priorities have shifted, and really it got ratcheted up. You could see it. You could see it and taste it in around 2008 when we were starting to get hints. In 2007, I was already talking about a bubble, but in 2008, the government started talking about a bubble. And if you recall, the Bush administration sent Treasury envoys, Hank Paulson, who was the Treasury Secretary at the time, and other envoys around the world. And they didn't go to Europe or anything like that. They went to China. They went to the Persian Gulf. They went to Singapore, asking for money to help bail us out of this, impending crisis. And the rest of the world told us to go stick it, largely because they had all bet a lot of money on Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers and had lost a lot of money there. And basically that set us up for taking on a tremendous amount of debt to bail ourselves out. And what it showed was that the power of liquidity had shifted. It had shifted to China. It had shifted to the Far East. It had shifted to the Middle East. And when you look at these governments, they're very different than us. They are, state capitalist countries. They can have different agendas than we do. And we no longer really can control where the money goes and why. And that removes a lot of our geopolitical influence in ways that we never really considered before until this started happening.
You make a statement in your book that, I'll be paraphrasing this, American-style capital markets have conquered the world. What did you mean by that?
Well, even everybody talks about, communist China, but the style of capitalism, the market style of capitalism, even in states where, you have, the supposedly the sharing of, the capitalist mechanisms and, equality among all people, that has been, whether you want to say debunked or destroyed, however you want to put it, it doesn't really exist anymore. Even China utilizes a form of capitalism. So they've taken, it's not as if we let the genie out of the bottle. We just sort of handed over the genie and allowed other people to utilize it the way they want. So China's version of capitalism may be very different than ours, but it still uses the mechanisms of the free market, or of the market, of the financial markets. And what that does is it makes them a player. When you look at what the Soviet Union did, it totally separated itself from the rest of the world. It had its own coordinated group, and it financed itself. As we realize now, it fell apart doing that. But it did not participate, so it didn't give them a say-so in the rest of the world in the way that, say, a China does have now, because it participates in this financial market, and it recognizes that it needs to, and that's actually good for them. Whether it's good for us, that's another question. But for them, it's really worked out quite well for the time being.
I'd like to pose, I'd like to toss something out here and have you react to it that
sure.
has been on my mind. It was one of the things that attracted me to this book as a discussion topic for today. It seems to me that there's been a real shift in the kind of capitalism that is practiced in the world mm-hmm. Over the last 50 to 100 years. Capitalism was, at one point, it involved building a factory and manufacturing some product and selling it, and you create capital. Capital was a physical thing. It was the machinery on your shop floor. It was your inventory, and it wasn't just a piece of paper in a vault someplace. And people went to work and they exchanged labor for pay. It was not always an equal exchange, but it was an exchange,
mm-hmm.
and that's how capitalism worked. It seems to me that in the 1980s, we saw a real shift into a different style of capitalism, which mostly involves trading pieces of paper and seemingly arbitrary statements about what those papers are worth, and a whole lot less about actually making things or exchanging labor for wealth.
Okay, that is true to an extent. I would push up the date a little bit into the 90s when, junk bonds did a bit of this, but when you look at still industrial production in the country, the financial sector didn't take up the amount that it does right now. And it was really, it was the creation of all these exotic products and the ability to trade. When you look at the way Wall Street has gone, Wall Street was essentially a middleman. And a relatively small business at that, and the capital was the partners. My first book was an oral history of Wall Street, so I really got a great background on how this all developed. And what happened was, sort of in the 1990s, the traders took over for the bankers. And there's a difference between a trader and a banker. A banker puts together deals, whereas a trader just does what you do, which is what you just described, which is pushing around paper. The question of whether all this proprietary trading, which is the trading that the banks do on their own, whether any of that is remotely good for the economy and beneficial is worthy of a question. And whether the compensation that these traders get, that's not even a debate. I mean, that seems to me to be insane. It's like, you know, how much we pay a baseball player. It's just a completely skewed version of the economic worth. But that said, if you look at the recovery to the extent that we're having one right now, it's being led by the industrial sector. And even if you look at what happened during the internet bubble, obviously everybody focuses on sock puppets and, you know, that was all a fraud and whatever else. But we ended up actually overbuilding our infrastructure. You know, Cisco way overextended itself in building out this electronic infrastructure that we happen to be using right now. So that was, you know, you at the time it was an overreach, and it was because everybody was investing in internet stocks and whatever else. So Cisco was just going through the moon, and they had more money than they could possibly put to use. But they eventually built something of worth. Now, the last crisis, the biggest problem is that there was none of that. This last crisis really was a crisis of us just going crazy hog wild on free money or cheap money, and it was encouraged by the government. I mean, if you just take a step back and look at the ebb and flow of markets, In 2001, we have the worst terrorist attack on our homeland ever. And at the same time, the market is, the stock market and the financial markets are falling apart because the internet is being exposed as a, you know, the internet bubble is being exposed as, you know, partly a fraud. And so if you look at those two dynamics, you should have expected a massive, massive market shock that would have sent all the indices down for a while. We would have gone to a recession, whatever else. And that just didn't happen. So what happened was the Bush administration kicked in, you know, and then with the help of the Fed, kicked in a very cheap financing program to keep the capital flowing, but we weren't creating anything anymore. We were just trading houses or, you know, trading companies or trading whatever else, but we weren't, there was no innovation. There was no, as the Dow climbed to 14,000 back in like in 2007, there was nothing pushing it other than, you know, the paper behind it. And that's really where we get into trouble, because, and that's why I say this last decade is where this has kicked in, because who was buying this paper? Where was this money coming from? It's, the misnomer is that the Fed just prints money. What the Fed does is it can do things to reduce interest rates on bonds and whatever else, but somebody's got to buy these bonds. Now, sometimes the Fed buys them themselves, but you have foreign entities coming in and buying these bonds in large quantities, and we need them to in order to keep ourselves afloat. But eventually, when you do that, it's like, you know, you owe a lot of money to your bank and you know, try to go refinance the figures, and they're like, no. And that's, you know, the position we put ourselves in is that we used to be the banker to the world, and now we have handed ourselves over to a whole new set of bankers. And that we were not doing anything to promote this. We weren't, like, you putting their capital to use to build, you know, great, you know, say green products that people need or railroads or whatever else, you know, that would be really productive for our economy. We just flipped houses. And that's really where the pain comes in, because that eventually you have to have a reckoning on this, and we're feeling the reckoning.
We're talking with Eric Weiner, the author of the new book, The Shadow Market, How a Group of Wealthy Nations and Powerful Investors Secretly Dominate the World. And wondering what you think about all of this. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That's the number to call toll free to join the discussion. You can also send an email, talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. Or find the Kathleen Dunn Facebook fan page and leave a message there. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. 20 minutes after 10 o'clock, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. Here's what's coming up later on the Ideas Network. After one on Talk of the Nation, environmental crimes and punishments. That's after one on Talk of the Nation here on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're talking about the new book, The Shadow Market, How a Group of Wealthy Nations and Powerful Investors Secretly Dominate the World. We have the author of that book, Eric Weiner, with us by phone. You can join the discussion by phone as well at 800-642-1234. And before we take some calls, I want to establish a few other things. Eric Weiner, who are the current players in the shadow market? Who, you mentioned China, you mentioned Singapore, there are some other countries involved and some wealthy individuals. Who are we talking about?
Well, it's a network that is loosely formed, to put it mildly. Basically, what you have, China is the biggest player, and that's really the one that geopolitically we have to watch. The United States has to do something about that. But
own all our paper.
They own all our paper, and in addition to that, and you're starting to see it, because of their size. They are able to influence geopolitical policy and, you know, obstruct geopolitical policy in ways that, you know, have never been done before. The whole North Korea thing. Take a look at, you know, that basically they own North Korea, and they've shown the ability to put their foot down on the throat of any number of countries, including us, when they don't like something. Yet somehow North Korea launches a missile at an island controlled by South Korea, which is, you know, our ally, and that's China's biggest problem because they really want to control the South Sea. So they launched this missile at South Korea, and suddenly all these stories about China that had been going on for like the last 2 months, you couldn't open up a paper and see another story about how they're doing this terrible thing, or they're manipulating this, or they're doing this for their currency. All these stories disappear, and suddenly we're talking about how we need China to help us negotiate with North Korea, and China's saying, well, hey, we can't control these crazy guys. And, you know, China has shown an extreme amount of ability to control things even that they don't have any say in. They've influenced Japan, they've influenced all sorts of countries, but somehow this tiny North Korea that they own, they can't control. And the point is that they were showing the world that it's like, hey, we can let these guys go off half-cocked if you want us to, or we can, you know, work together on this. And this enables them to have a chip in an argument where we're trying to get them to agree to environmental standards and human rights standards and change their position on the yuan. So they are able to influence the world in ways that they never could before because of the amount of money that they have, and that's what makes this dangerous. And this is the danger of what's been termed state capitalism. I mean, we can discuss how much involvement our country has in running our businesses in the corporate sector, but we don't actually own anything outright. You know, when Microsoft makes a profit, or when, you know, Exxon makes a profit, the profit goes up, you know, the ladder of the corporation, and then it goes out to, you know, shareholders and whatever else. In China, those profits directly roll up to the government because the government owns the businesses in some form or another. In the case of oil, I mean, they actually own the companies outright. You know, so it's a very, very different relationship. Our relationship is sort of a taxing relationship where, you know, the government gets a portion of the profits. Here, it's the government gets the profits and then it decides how much to distribute to the people. It's totally reversed. So China is really the one to watch. But the other players are not exactly who you'd expect. They're these tiny little countries in the Persian Gulf, say Abu Dhabi or Qatar. Well, if you look at the whole debate about the World Cup recently and Qatar gets the World Cup, well, why do you think that was? You know, we wanted it. And normally when we want something, we get it. But somehow Qatar gets in there. Now, how did that happen? Because they have a lot of money. And when you look at Qatar's bid for the World Cup, they're talking about building like 10 stadiums that are indoor outdoor that are fully air conditioned. We can't do that. We don't have the money to do that. So it's like the amount of capital that these countries have that are very tiny. I mean, they're like, you know, 800,000 people, and they have, you know, a GDP that's comparable to, you know, a really rising country. It's pretty miraculous. So that gives them the ability to do all sorts of different things within the market and make them players. We have to go to them. The biggest of the bunch would be Saudi Arabia. But, like, they're a tiny little country, Kuwait, Abu Dhabi, you name it. And if you just look at, like, what happened recently with Dubai over the last year where, you know, Dubai, it looked like it was going to fall apart. It looked like Ireland or Spain or any of the Greece or any of the other countries in Europe that are having trouble. But the difference is that they have very rich friends. So when Dubai gets into trouble, Abu Dhabi steps in and says, okay, well, you know, we'll take care of this. And suddenly it's off the front page of the paper. But there's nobody to do that for Ireland. There's nobody to do that for these other countries, you know, in Europe, because they don't have the money to do it. So what? And again, it's state capitalism, because if you look at all of these wealthy Persian Gulf countries, they're basically family-run businesses. I mean, you know, a guy from the National Security Agency described Saudi Arabia as the largest, you know, family-owned business in the world, and in effect, it is. And that's what gives a tremendous amount of power right now to these people, because it's all about concentrated wealth and then how you distribute it. And what they're doing is they are looking at our hedge funds, they're looking at our private equity funds, and they're developing strategies based on those funds. So they looked at, like, David Swensen at the Yale Endowment, which is a very successful investing outfit, and have copied him. They've invested directly in, you know, our big investing firms, you know, that do private equity and hedge funds like Blackstone Group. Just recently, Abu Dhabi increased its ownership stake in the Carlyle Group in D.C. to like 10%. And nobody talks about this, but, you know, Carlyle is extraordinarily powerful and very inside baseball. And, you know, Abu Dhabi, the nation of Abu Dhabi, owns like 10% of them. Well, that puts them in a very powerful position to see what's going on in the markets, to understand how they should position themselves, to speak to major, major figures in our government and whatever, in very different ways. It's one thing for Abu Dhabi to approach our government as a sovereign government, and it's another thing to approach our government as a 10% owner in Carlyle. And that's kind of what they're doing, is that, you know, slowly but surely, they're using our mechanisms of capitalism, our growth engines of capitalism, to their own benefit, and those companies are allowing it to happen because, you know, Carlyle needs the money, Abu Dhabi has it, so here we go, we're partners. And the ramifications of that sort of, you know, spin out, aren't really thought about until it's too late.
We have full phone lines, so let's take some calls. Daryl and Couturier, you'll be first. Good morning, Daryl. Thanks for holding.
Good morning, and thanks for taking my call, and hello, Mr. Warner. This question is a compound question. It's kind of off the wall, I'll admit, but it is, or they are. Could there be a world without money? Further, would humans benefit from not using money? Now, let's say the focus of worth was based on time. It's said that time is money, but could the reverse be practical? Thank you.
Well, the only problem with that is that historically we would have to rewrite a lot of what we understand about economics to do that. It's what you describe is a much fairer distribution of wealth, but like the Phoenicians invented money. So we've been using a symbolic structure, say, to back our trade for you know, time immemorial, you know, thousands and thousands of years. So the point of money is to improve trade and to make trade easier, because trade is the way economies grow, by, you know, selling and buying goods. The problem is that right now, the reason you're asking this question is that money is in the way because of the way that we twisted the value of it. It's not so much that money is the problem, it's the way that we've utilized money. When we turned money into a number that can just be bounced around the globe, that's when things got dangerous. So it's
we turned it into a product, didn't we? I mean, talk about the difference between the amount of cash that's traded every day and the value of all the goods that are produced in a year in the world. I mean, the numbers there are staggering.
But it's even better. The better way to look at it right now is that we owe our debt to GDP ratio, which is something that, like, economists look at, but now is something that the average person should really start paying attention to, is 100%. So what that means is that, and it's going to go up, what that means is that for every dollar that we produce, that our industry produces, it is represented by a dollar of debt that our government owes. So we'd like have this paper out there that is completely consuming the goods and the time that gentleman spoke about before, the goods that we produce. It's all being subsumed, and guess who's benefiting? Countries that we don't even necessarily agree with. So it's like we've really allowed this whole system to be twisted in a way that, you know, we hadn't, because we've sort of done things on the fly, we never really thought about the ramifications. We just kept trying to solve the problem in front of us. And now we're sitting here going, oh, my God, 10 steps down the road, this really doesn't work.
We'll go to Appleton next and hear from Dave. Dave, good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, all these things are happening, and we have elections in the United States, and the thing that most people focus on is gee, is someone taking welfare, or aren't immigrants really ripping us off, or, you know, something about my neighbor and gays got guns. I mean, the American people, we're missing the point. The things that are driving us to the bottom are external, and most people are being driven off, are simply being immersed in that tidal wave, and we don't understand it. It's beyond the individual's control. It's much larger, and we're not even thinking about it on a national level because we're so internally, provincially focused.
Well, it's funny you mention immigration, because for this book, my first book, as I said, was an oral history of Wall Street, and I basically spoke to a lot of guys in New York, and everything was very U.S. focused. But this book was very different for me because I had to speak to people all over the world, and I got a really good sense of what they're about, and I also got a really good sense of what they like and dislike about us. And one of the things that countries really admire about us is, believe it or not, our ability to integrate immigrants, because immigration is what will keep the United States from ossifying in terms of age the way Europe is. So, and if you look at the way Europe has integrated its immigrants, it creates ghettos for them. You know, you go to Paris and see how, the immigrants from Africa and from their former colonies are treated. Same thing in England. And it's just different here. There is sort of a path to growth, and we should be thanking God for that and encouraging that. That is one of our biggest strengths, and it's what the rest of the world that is developing looks at and says, okay, that's something we would want to emulate if we could. And instead, we sit around fighting over, like, you know, how many Mexicans should be allowed in this country.
Well, it's bread and circuses.
What's that?
It's bread and circuses.
Yeah, exactly. And we're not understanding what our strengths are and what our weaknesses are. Our strengths are that we keep replenishing. And our strengths are that, you know, there's always this dream out there that, like, you know, there are a couple guys working at IBM who are going to, you know, come up with a great idea, leave IBM, start it, you know, and then that's going to reinvent the world. And we actually do this, but instead we take away people's health care and we fight over immigration. And by doing all that, we kill the entrepreneurial spirit that actually is what drives our economy and makes it more innovative than any other economy in the world. And we're not taking the steps to take advantage of that. Instead, we're fighting over the pieces.
Let's Dave, thanks for that call. Let's go next to Marinette and hear from Steve. Steve, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'm just kind of curious about how our huge military relates to all this, since they don't produce anything and we spend a lot of money on it. And are these new bankers to the world thrilled when we go into a war like Iran and spend trillions of dollars or whatever the end line will be, and not produce anything, and just keep us tied up in all of our money and increase our debt?
Well, the shadow market loves that, because they get the debt. I'll tell you an interesting story out of the book. In the first chapter of the book, I talk about a war game exercise. It's the first time the Pentagon had done this. They held an economic war game. And what happened was, it was sort of, they described it as Dr. Strangelove to me. Nobody would really talk about it that much, but there aren't many records of it happening, but it did happen, and it got a little bit of coverage at the time, and I found out a whole heck of a lot more about it. But what happened was that they took all these economists and Wall Street traders and executives, you know, real on-the-ground pros, and rather than having, you know, soldiers in the room doing the war game exercise, they had bankers, and they divvied them up. And they said, okay, you know, you're the United States, you're China, you're Russia, you're the EU, you're the IMF. And they had a bunch of proctors in front of the room, and they would introduce, you know, dramatic but, say, plausible, you know, scenarios. So, like, you know, North Korea is going to bomb somebody, or, you know, a major economy is tanking and their currency is falling through the ground. And they tell everybody what do you, you know, do what you would want to do. And what they found was that we lost every time. And the reason that we lost every time was we were easily diverted into fights, particularly over various different side issues that had nothing to do with the formal goal of, like, keeping our economy going during this crisis. And what would happen is China would just pick our bones.
So by lost, what do you mean we lost? I mean, in a war, usually they're about territory. I mean, you gain or lose territory, you acquire control. So what would it mean to lose a financial war?
Well, that's what's interesting. What would happen is that we would dramatically reduce ourselves, and then whatever the geopolitical dispute was about, we could no longer influence. And it happened again and again and again. So, like, if the goal was to neutralize Korea, then we would want to have a say in that. But because a lot of different things would go on, and we would get involved in these side disputes, we would lose our influence in that position, or we would lose our influence, you know, whatever the structure of a bailout of a falling currency would look like. It would look a lot less like what we wanted, and a lot more like what, say, China wanted. And when I talked to, you know, none of these guys wanted to go on the record, but they were actually very forthcoming because they want this information to be understood. They came out of there, and one of the guys said, you know, we just lost sight of what the hell we were doing. And it happens again and again. And the fundamental question that, and this is coming from the NSA and the CIA, that's who set this up. I mean, this started years ago, out in Los Alamos. This was, you know, serious stuff. They were like, do we want to have, or can we afford to have, the biggest military on Earth and play the role of the world's cop when we no longer have the largest economy, which is what's coming when you look at where China's coming from? And that ostensibly, you know, nobody wants to call out the Iraq war. Nobody wants to call out the Afghanistan war if you're in the CIA or the NSA. You know, that's sort of verboten. But they're questioning the whole idea of it. And so if you look at what's gone on with Iraq and Afghanistan and look at how much money we're spending, well, would we be better off, you know, getting our healthcare system set up? Would we be better off, you know, taking care of some things at home? Or are we better off fighting wars in places that we have no reason to be there? They don't want us there. And we're spending a tremendous amount of money. I mean, just the average payload of a bomb being dropped somewhere, you know, could, like, take care of, you know, several families for years. And so it's like, is that the most effective use of our resources? And there's this group within the government that pushes this along. This goes back to Eisenhower. You know, this is the
military-industrial complex?
Exactly. And it's just a modern form of it. But so there's this group within the government that sort of moves this thing along. And in reality, it is no longer the most effective use of our resources. Now, if the army is going to be innovative with green technology, and then that technology is going to be able to be used in our economy, well, that's something that we would want to look at. But in terms of actually just, you know, going out there and fighting everybody, that's just not a policy that's going to really work well for us in the long term, particularly as we move toward an economic geopolitical world as opposed to a physical fighting geopolitical world.
Well, you know, that's really interesting because the idea of being able to project power has been tied to, has been tied to having a big navy, going back to the British Empire.
Mm-hmm.
And the United States has the world's largest navy. And we look at, and some people will look at China and say, well, the People's Liberation Army Navy is a joke. They don't have a navy. They can't project any power. But if I'm hearing you right, they don't need a navy.
Well,
they can turn ours off.
They're building one, but they're building one for the size in which they feel is required. And really what China is interested in, and this I got lecture after lecture from Asian specialists that, you know, because the idea is that China has actually throughout history has been a massive economy and the biggest economy in the world. And you can debate when that ended. But, I mean, they know how to run an empire was their point. So the idea that China isn't going to know what to do when it takes over to them is ludicrous. And China has always really cared about fundamentally its backyard. So it's going to want to control the South China Sea and that whole area and make sure that nobody can mess around in its own backyard. And then other than that, it tends to be more isolationist. And that's a typical stance in a developing economy, and we'll see how long that can last. But the point is that they're not building an army to take over the world. they're building a treasury to take over the world. And it's a very different thing. But if you think about it, economics and geopolitics have always been tied. You know, it was our economic strength after World War II that enabled us to do what we did in Korea and to do what we did in Vietnam, because other countries sort of had to go along with us. You know, we're buying it, we're paying for England's recovery. So, of course, they're going to support us. But as these relationships change, and as China suddenly, other countries are more reliant on China for their capital and for their aid and for whatever else, they're going to be less likely to take them on. So where does that leave us? That leaves us as, you know, okay, we've got this big old army, but we still need allies. And China could have a smaller army, but a bigger war chest of dollars. And that makes them a whole heck of a lot more appealing to, you know, to a world where alliances matter.
We have full phones. We'll take some more phone calls in just a moment. Just a reminder, we're talking about the book, The Shadow Market, How a Group of Wealthy Nations and Powerful Investors Secretly Dominate the World. We have its author with us today, Eric Weiner. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10:44. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later on, after 5, in these tough economic times, Ben Maron's guest has tips on how you can set up a family budget, a look at how to set financial goals and priorities for next year. That's after 5 o'clock today on At Issue with Ben Maron's. This hour, we're talking about the book, The Shadow Market, How a Group of Wealthy Nations and Powerful Investors Secretly Dominate the World, published by Scribner and written by Eric J. Weiner. And Eric Weiner is with us by phone, and so is Gary in Fitchburg. Gary, good morning.
Hey, yes, the powerful people dominate not only the world financial operations, but certainly our country politically. We now have a system where both the Democratic and Republican parties are bought and paid for by the oligarchs who have no allegiance to the United States. We see China going around making deals for natural resources around the country with Africa, many places around the world. They just did a deal with Pakistan where they're going to build a highway from Pakistan that will link to China. Well, we, the United States, with our big war machine, go around making enemies around the world. People in Pakistan, the majority of those people now hate our guts, as do the majority of the people in Afghanistan and Iraq and Palestinians and many other people around the world. We need somehow to get back to looking at our government and getting people in our government that care about the people of the United States. You cannot have an economy that functions with people working at the dollar store in cash for titles while the war machine goes around filling the pockets of the military-industrial complex. It's insanity on steroids, and I don't see any positive outlook on the horizon because both parties have been co-opted by the oligarchs who have robbed this country blind.
Gary, thanks for the comments. Eric Weiner?
Well, I don't disagree. I mean, I don't know about the oligarch part, but the bigger problem that I see in Washington is that it's just not addressing this issue. And it's not that there aren't some smart people. I mean, it's not that everybody in Washington is a dullard. There are smart people, and particularly in the economic world, there are smart people. But we always get fixated on fixing the last crisis. So we're looking, you know, how did the last crisis happen? Just look at the books that have been produced, you know, over the last year. All of them deal with what happened before. Very few deal with what's coming forward. And so if you look around and you look at what the government is doing, I mean, whatever the government is doing to fix things relates to our problems before. And then when you look at, you know, tax cuts and, you know, tax cuts and increased spending, I mean, that goes back to Johnson and guns and butter. You know, it just doesn't really work, and it leaves you in a very weakened position. The difference is that in the 1970s, after all that went on, we were in a weakened position, and we went through a heck of a bad decade. But the rest of the world did too, and there wasn't anybody to really check us, other than the Soviet Union at the time, which was falling apart, as we later found out. Now there is. So if we go through a tough time, there will be a winner on the other side. And that's where, when you're talking about China doing deals for resources, yeah, all over the world. And it's not just China. Saudi Arabia has a farm the size of Connecticut in Indonesia. And they're basically producing rice and a couple of other grains that are used by the Saudis. And obviously the Saudi land doesn't really lend itself much to agriculture. So they're basically going out and buying it. And the rest of the world is looking at this and saying, oh, great, you know, we can use the dough. And the ramifications of this are alliances, are, you know, a lot from alliances to exploitation. You can take it all the way down the line. And that's where, you know, we are reducing our ability to have any say in this instead of increasing it.
Let's go to Hunter's Lake, take a call now from Brian. Brian, good morning.
Hello. Very interesting. I have two quick points. Under President Clinton, it seemed like he cared about the greater good, including around the world, and it seems economically it responded, and of course there were great surpluses. And the second point is this Glenn Beck, Keith Olbermann calls him Lonesome Rhodes, and he's on this campaign. First it was Fan Johnson, and now he's going after George Soros, liberal billionaire. And I just thought that was done in the McCarthy area. And lastly, Paul Ryan is being called, you know, the smartest economist in political office, and I just don't get it. It sounds about as stupid as that mayor in Milwaukee giving up an $800 million rail system. I'd like to hear your guests respond.
Well, it's, I mean, there's demonization. This is what the shadow market loves. I mean, when we are fighting over you know, whether George Soros should be demonized or not, and we're not addressing, but when you talk about the Clinton era, what you hit on was the key, which is the focus on reducing the deficit and the debt while not reducing economic growth. And that was done in a lot of different ways. As far as our military was concerned, though, we did use it. I mean, you know, just look at the Balkan, you know, the Kosovo and all that. So we certainly did use the military, and we used the military to actually spread freedom, because that's what, you know, we were doing in Serbia and Kosovo and all that. So it's not as if we didn't have that sort of almost Reagan-esque doctrine under Clinton. It's just that we ran our economy more efficiently. When I talk to people on both sides of this debate, they say that, and I'm talking like inside guys, you know, CIA, NSA, guys who are, you know, apolitical, and just want, you know, are really about what's smartest. They talk about the policy of containment that was used by Bush won, you know, after Reagan, when we go into Iraq and we're, you know, going to liberate Kuwait. And basically the reason we liberate Kuwait is because we got so much money from them. We got so much oil from them. So, I mean, you can argue over whether that was a great idea or not. But the point was is that there was this whole group pushing to go to Baghdad. But, you know, the Baker, Bush, you know, realpolitik crowd wouldn't go for that, and that was why the last Bush, George W. Bush, got so much heat from his father's advisors, Scowcroft and whoever else, because they weren't following the idea of prudence. Just have a goal, have it attainable, get it done, and get the heck out of there. And this is the way that you're not going to tick people off, and it's the way that you can use your military forces most efficiently. You know, Rumsfeld, when you heard what he was talking about when the war started, well, we can run this on a small scale, and we don't need that many soldiers. It's the same point. He's trying to say we can do this on the cheap, but rather than saying that the goal needs to be adjusted, his point was that all we need to do is adjust the personnel, and that was proven to be fraudulent and ridiculous. And you know, we can all argue or agree over how good a defense secretary he was, but this was where the CIA and NSA guys were going crazy, because they were like, it's just we already saw that this doesn't work, and even though Kosovo was a liberation movement, it's not like going into Afghanistan and Pakistan, let alone Iraq. I mean, there was a much more, you had a lot of allies. Holbrooke had done all this work to bring together a group, as well as Madeleine Albright. So it was a very different situation and a much smaller operation. What we've gotten ourselves into now is like a never-ending war on a massive scale that we can't afford. And that, in the long run, is going to kill us.
Well, we made the assumption that where everyone else failed, that because we were America and we always win, we would be able to succeed.
Yeah. The whole thing is this, that we were, to give you a little personal information, my wife was actually in the World Trade Center the day it was bombed. And we were living in New York at the time. We live in Western Massachusetts now, but we were living in the city at the time, so we were very much a part of 9/11. And when they started talking about sending, a limited number of troops in to go after and go, we're going to get bin Laden, that to me at the time, having my wife been attacked, made quite a bit of sense. But then we banged this left pretty quickly, and we're going to go to Iraq. And in the meantime, we completely destabilize Afghanistan, and we go to Iraq for no reason. Now, if we had maintained the focus of, look, we're not going to save Afghanistan, the Russians have failed, everybody's always failed that, but we're going to get this guy. Well, they supposedly had him cornered in Tora Bora or whatever else. But if that was the focus, you got to believe that that might have happened. But it's when we start fighting huge, huge wars on multiple fronts, and in areas of the world that literally hate us, you look at it and it's like, this is just not tenable. This is not tenable. And this is what the Bush one guy saw.
And it's not tenable if you don't have a plan to pay for it. I mean, if you look at wars in the past, there was a tax surcharge. There was always a tax increase that went along with it, because you knew you had to have the money to pay. You had to have the money to fight the war.
Yeah, and we never even considered that, because we were just printing money. And, that the economic side of the Bush organization didn't want to admit that it was inflating a bubble, and the Fed didn't want to fight the idea that by creating cheap money, it was creating a dangerous situation. And it just seemed like, okay, well, we can go about doing, what we want to do. And the idea that, China would never do that right now. And when we look at the world, we need to look at, wait a second, what are we doing? And what would the world, A, want us to do? And what's in our best interest? And it doesn't seem like we do that.
Well, it seems to me that what we're describing is the difference between intelligence and wisdom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're not very wise.
We've got about 2 minutes left, Eric Weiner. I want us to try and wrap up this discussion and maybe come to some sort of a conclusion. What if someone in the Obama administration put in a phone call to you this afternoon and said, Eric, we're clueless about this whole thing. What should we do? What would you tell them? What can the United States do to change this, if anything?
Well, it can do quite a bit, because we didn't talk about what the United States has, and that is a very appealing economy. When you talk to the rest of the world, they like the fact that, you can come here and succeed. They like the fact that we do innovate. There's no other country in the world that has, you could take our industrial base to Hollywood, to Silicon Valley, to Wall Street. So many different facets of the world run through here that, we cannot be ignored. And so that strength should be played up to. We need to get the debt down to a reasonable ratio. We're not going to get rid of it, but a reasonable ratio of GDP. Right now it's at 100%. So if we took it down to 50%, well, that would make a whole heck of a lot of sense. Now, where do you cut? I don't think you want to cut entitlements during this economy. I don't think that you want to put a lot of spending back on the backs of the middle class. I think that the rich could pay a little bit more, but, you know, obviously John Boehner disagrees. But the bigger point is that we can't overextend ourselves. I would immediately reassess our military commitments and what we want to do, because if you look at it, that's a third of our budget. And if we can really ratchet that down, we can do a lot of things in terms of getting our fiscal house in order. If our fiscal house is in order, then the debate becomes, is it necessary for us to be the biggest economy in the world to be the best? And I think the book is out on that, because we can be nimble, we can be smart, but are we capable of being nimble and smart? I haven't seen the evidence of that yet, and that's what depresses me.
Eric Weiner, thank you for joining us this morning to talk about your book. I really appreciate your time today.
Oh, thanks, John. I really enjoyed it.
Eric Weiner is the author of The Shadow Market, How a Group of Wealthy Nations and Powerful Investors Secretly Dominate the World. He's a former columnist and Wall Street reporter for Dow Jones Newswires, The Wall Street Journal, Los Angeles Times, Boston Globe, Village Voice. Quite a resume. Rhonda Fanning produced this program. Erica Janik handled on-air production. I'll be back tomorrow with 2 hours of interesting discussion. Hope you'll join me from 9 to 11 tomorrow morning. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.